Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt, and welcome to It's Our Money. It is our money, but we've lost control over it. The power to create and control our money supply has been usurped by a private banking cartel. They create money when they make loans. They do it by double-entry bookkeeping. When you go to the bank, for example, to take out a mortgage, they will write your promise to pay on one side of their books as an asset to themselves because you have promised to pay them that sum over time, and they'll write it on the other side of their books as a liability to themselves because when you write that check to your seller, the bank is on the hook to pay that sum. So from their point of view, their books balance and they haven't really created anything. They've created, let's say, $500,000 on one side, $500,000 as a positive or an asset, and $500,000 as a negative or a liability. So at the bottom, it all comes out to zero, and so they say they haven't really created anything. But your check that goes to the seller goes into another bank, and then that bank counts it as a deposit, and then they can use that to create more debt. So it's your promise to pay that has been monetized and turned into money that circulates in the money supply as what we use for commerce. The problem is that all of this debt comes into existence with interest attached. So there's always more money owed back than was created in the first place. Now, where is that extra money supposed to come from? Somewhere, somebody has to take out another loan since bank loans are the principal source of our money. So what you have is this burgeoning debt pyramid, this pyramid scheme where more and more money has to be sucked in at the bottom in order to support the lenders at the top. And the inherent fraud in the system is that they are charging us as if they were lending their money, but in fact, they're lending our own money. They're turning our money, our promises to pay, into money. What we really have is just a giant mutual credit clearing system, which could be done as a public service. Credit could be a public utility without the need of private banker bonuses, fees, commissions, interest at all. So that's what we want to look at in this program, how we can get from what we've got, which is a sort of parasitic scheme, which is sucking the lifeblood out of us, to a system of abundance where we can maximize our potential by putting all our resources into real things, real productive things, and paying people for their real labor and not just for creaming profits off the top of other people's labor. The whole thing is pretty complicated, and people tend to throw up their hands and say, I'll just leave it to the experts. But that's what the experts want us to do, or at least some of the experts. So in this program, we'll be talking to friendly experts who will give us some insights into what's really going on behind the facade of modern banking and finance. Today, particularly, we'll be focusing on the Federal Reserve. The Fed has been in the news lately. For one thing, Janet Yellen just got sworn in as the first ever woman chairperson of the Federal Reserve, a rather momentous event. And the Federal Reserve itself had its 100th birthday on December 23rd, also a momentous event. So it's a good opportunity to be asking whether the Fed has achieved its intended purposes, whether it has tools that might be used to come out with a better result than we've gotten in recent years. to explore these issues with us. I'm very pleased to be able to talk with the sharpest and most knowledgeable person I know on the subject, Professor Timothy Canova. Tim is currently Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida. He has written dozens of articles and book chapters, including in the Harvard Law Review and the Georgetown Law Review. He has also practiced law at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in New York City, taught at a number of universities, served as legislative assistant to the late Senator Paul Tsongas, and served on an advisory committee put together by Senator Bernie Sanders on reforming the Federal Reserve. So he's seen these issues from both the academic side and the more practical operational side, and he should be able to give us some insights in what the Fed has done before and what it's really capable of, what tools it has. Greetings, Tim.
Greetings. Nice to be with you, Ellen.
I've been reading your latest piece on these questions. It's a chapter in a book called When Government Helped. Your chapter is called The Bottom-Up Recovery, A New Deal in Banking and Public Finance. I particularly like the opening quote. It's from Franklin Roosevelt, 1932. He said, "The country needs, and unless I mistake its temper, the country demands bold, persistent experimentation. It is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something. The millions who are in watch will not stand by silently forever while the things that satisfy their needs are within easy reach." I particularly like that quote because I'm a bit anxious about starting this show, but Franklin Roosevelt was such a great example of, I mean, he was like a total cripple, and he was, I saw this in a documentary, he was actually faking being able to walk when he couldn't, and there was Hoover sort of shriveled up and nervous and afraid to do anything, and Franklin Roosevelt just boldly strove out there and tried one thing after another, and it worked. It was great.
It's true. It really is. His administration really should be an example for us today. The book that you mentioned, When Government Helped, is all about trying to learn lessons from both the successes and the failures from the New Deal.
What I really want to get to is where you said at the end about how the Federal Reserve was circumscribed by the Dodd-Frank Act from doing much in the way of helping the economy, but there's still ways it could be done. But Ben Bernanke wasn't the person to do it, so I wanted to ask if Janet Yellen might be. But that's pretty, you know, first we have to lay some basic groundwork, so I'll ask you more basic questions to start. It's often debated, and I often get asked the question myself, whether the Federal Reserve is public or private. How would you answer that, and what does it consist of?
Well, it's got public responsibilities. It wields public authority. It was created by Congress, and yet it's very much a private entity in the way that it's dominated by private banking interests. Private banking interests that literally own the regional Federal Reserve banks, and they dominate the Federal Open Market Committee by having, five voting members at every meeting, but all 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents are present and have a voice, if not always a vote, at the Federal Open Market Committee meetings. And that Federal Open Market Committee is the key policy-making, monetary policy-making committee of the Federal Reserve. So it's a hybrid type of an institution where private interests really do dominate and are able to wield public authority in ways that quite often are skewed and help the private banking interests more than Main Street interests.
And so could that be fixed? Or what?
I think it should be fixed. I think it needs to be fixed. There are some who have said, let's just essentially nationalize the Federal Reserve System. Essentially, there shouldn't be private banks owning the regional Federal Reserve banks. And other reforms that have been mentioned would be to make the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks subject to appointment by the President of the United States and confirmation by the U.S. Senate. Which seems entirely reasonable since they are acting as federal officers, they should have to go through the confirmation process and the presidential appointments process. I favor more far-reaching reforms than just making the heads of the regional Federal Reserve Banks subject to presidential appointment and Senate confirmation. I would like to see a Federal Reserve that actually has representation of many of society's diverse interests, including representatives of workers and of student debtors. It shouldn't just be a banker's club.
Yeah, that's great. I would agree with that. And you've also talked about that it's called independent, but it's not really independent. So what does that mean, in fact?
Yeah, this is one of the great myths, I think, of the Federal Reserve. We're all brought up to being taught that the Federal Reserve must be independent, meaning it must be independent of the politicians, because if the politicians run monetary policy, they'll just get drunk with power, they will print a lot of money, all to get reelected, and we'll have hyperinflation. And it's really just a cartoon characterization. It's very overblown concerns. And we've traded one type of independence for another, you could say, in that the Fed, while it might be rather independent of politicians on a day-to-day basis, it's not independent at all of Wall Street interests. It's entirely dominated and captured by the largest banks in the country. And it's a very troubling state of affairs when you have a captured agency with such power in the private financial markets.
You've also called it a cartel. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Well, the domination of the Fed is really a domination by the largest banks in the country. It's quite breathtaking to look at how concentrated banking has become in the United States over the past couple of decades, and really just since the financial crisis of 2008, it's become even more concentrated, with the largest six commercial banks now controlling more than two-thirds of the nation's deposits and assets, banking assets. And those are the institutions that really wield inordinate influence over the Fed, mostly through the control of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So, what is a cartel? It's really an oligopolistic structure where just a few firms collude together to set their prices and other industry practices. And this cartel is able to wield their power through a very organized institution, the Federal Reserve itself.
You've written some pretty interesting stuff on the Federal Reserve of the 30s and 40s and how it differed from the Fed of today. Could you comment on that?
It differed like night and day. The chairman of the Federal Reserve during most of the 1930s was a fellow named Mariner Eccles. And Eccles had been a banker from Utah. The Eccles family controlled much of a lot of different industries in the Utah economy. So it was a very influential and sophisticated business family. And when Eccles was appointed to head the Fed, he came with a much different perspective than we see today. Eccles' view was that what the country needed to get out of the Great Depression was massive jobs programs, public works programs. And the Federal Reserve, under his leadership, acted accordingly. On one hand, you could see some similarities in that Eccles Fed kept interest rates very low so that the federal government could borrow money. Of course, the borrowing that was done in the 1930s and the spending by the federal government was very geared towards public works and public jobs programs that accomplished an awful lot. And I think that's one of the huge differences between the economic policies of the 1930s and today. And the Federal Reserve wasn't just keeping interest rates low for the federal government. In fact, the Federal Reserve was actually making loans directly to Main Street to small businesses around the country. And this was under the Federal Reserve Act had a section called Section 13B, which had given the Federal Reserve that kind of authority. Today, there's a different section of the Federal Reserve Act, Section 13.3, which gives very similar type of authority for the Fed to make loans to really any corporation or partnership that is in need of working capital.
I really want to get into that. I'm really interested in that provision, but first I'll lay some more of this groundwork. So during the 30s and 40s, Roosevelt used the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to largely fund farmers and small business, et cetera. Why was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation the major funder of all this stuff instead of the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve traditionally didn't make loans directly to industry. And when Herbert Hoover was president and the Great Depression began in 1929, really, with the stock market crash, a few years later, in 1932, when Hoover was president, Congress created the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And Hoover used it mostly to make loans to banks and insurance companies and railroads. So very large institutions, you can say. And in some ways, very similar to the TARP program, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the way it was used. The TARP program was passed in the waning days of the Bush administration in 2008. TARP was used to shore up banks and insurance companies, and instead of railroads, it was the big auto companies. When Franklin Roosevelt was running against Hoover for president in 1932, Roosevelt denounced this type of a strategy, this approach as a trickle-down approach. That there were just millions of people who were in need of jobs, and shoring up big banks wasn't getting the job done. And Roosevelt had campaigned on using the Reconstruction Finance Corporation for what he called a bottom-up recovery. And that's exactly what happened after he took office. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation started to make loans and grants to fund public works programs. It made loans to help localities pay local school teacher salaries. It funded mortgage modifications, infrastructure building, and it's a piece of American history that really has been long forgotten. Over about a 20 to 25 year time span, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation pumped over $50 billion into the American economy, and it really is an example of a public bank at a federal level, really a public revolving fund, that was able to build a bottom-up recovery and to finance all kinds of amazing infrastructure and jobs programs that made the economy much stronger, both in the short and the long run.
I've written about that, too, and I think the reason it's been forgotten is that it's actually been suppressed because it was too good of a model. It was competing with all the private lenders and doing a much better job of it. It was much cheaper for the government and cheaper for the country.
Yes, I agree with you. I think the history has been suppressed precisely because it was so successful.
Yeah. But I'm actually not clear on, let's say the Federal Reserve was making a loan for whatever, farms or something, that it could do it in the nature of quantitative easing, just creating the credit on its books, right? Whereas the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, like you said, is a revolving fund, so it has to get the money first, and it would get the money by issuing bonds, is that correct? And then lend
yes.
it out to... Okay.
That is my understanding. That's right. So the Federal Reserve would have fewer impediments, you could say, to expanding its loan portfolio than a revolving fund that's like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that's really funded through the issuance of bonds. That gets to a bit of a discussion of the Fed's quantitative easing programs where it has purchased several $1 trillion of bonds, not just government bonds, but mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations as well.
I think the first QE program, QE1, the Fed purchased over $1.25 trillion of these mortgage-backed securities at a very critical time facing the American economy. It was really in a meltdown mode when QE1 began. And it was a great departure from the Fed's traditional monetary policy, where traditionally the Fed would only be purchasing Treasury securities and usually short-term Treasuries. And here, suddenly, it was in some ways adopting its own industrial policy, picking winners and losers and deciding that the banks that held a lot of mortgage-backed securities were not going to be allowed to fail. Instead, the Fed would take them off their those securities off their hands. And even the most recent QE program, the Fed has been purchasing, well, it started by purchasing $85 billion each and every month of a mix between almost half and half between Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. It's now tapering that, and it's down to about $65 billion a month. But there's still a breathtaking volume of purchasing by the Federal Reserve. And, you know, the Fed doesn't have to borrow money to make those purchases. It can create those reserves out of thin air. So you take a look at the Fed's books, $4 trillion of assets on its books as a result of these QE programs. And if it had, and that's a very trickle-down approach. It's pumping liquidity into the banks, hoping the banks will then lend the money to Main Street interests to create jobs. And that hasn't really been happening in the kind of volumes that would be needed to see a strong recovery. If the Fed had spent just a fraction of that in loans directly to Main Street interests, there are a number of possible strategies it could use to do that, but it could have been creating jobs directly and arguably bringing budget deficits for the federal government and state and local governments down, because as businesses get up and running and people start working again, those are tax-paying resources. So it's been a real failure by the Fed and a sharp contrast to what the Fed's strategy was during the 1930s. I mentioned during the 30s when the Fed made these loans to Main Street interests, it made, I believe, about $280 million in loans over the course of the 1930s, which I know $280 million doesn't sound like a lot now, but in the 1930s economy, it was a significant stimulus to the economy and created an awful lot of jobs.
But it was still less than the Reconstruction Finance Corporation made, right? Why was there not more emphasis on the Fed? Was there some limitation or some resistance to that way of making loans? Yeah, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation made more loans. Is that correct?
And yet there wasn't a the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was really in the neighborhood of the billions, while the Fed was only making, as I said, $280 million over the course of the next 30s. So it's a much lower volume, but in some ways, doesn't that really show that whole idea of bold, persistent experimentation, that the challenge that was facing the country was recognized by all, that there was a real crisis in the employment markets, and that they weren't going to rely just on one institution or one strategy to try to address the problem. Each institution felt some obligation to try to address the problem.
You said there were several ways that it could be done today, even with the limitations. So I know that when Ben Bernanke was asked, when he was thinking about what to do with QE2, and somebody asked him, what about making loans directly to municipal governments, because they're the ones that had been hurt by, you know, it was Wall Street's fault that they were losing revenues, and wouldn't they be appropriate parties to bail out? And he said that if Congress wanted him to do that, that they would have to change the Federal Reserve Act because it wasn't in there. They didn't give him the power to do that, except I think for very short term loans.
That was Ben Bernanke's response to me as well when I asked him the question directly on a telephone conference call. He claimed that he lacked the legal authority to do much of anything. It is true that the Dodd-Frank Act has tied the Fed's hands to some degree, in that the Fed can no longer be making supporting one company directly. We saw the Fed do this in 2008 when Bear Stearns was collapsing. The Fed essentially gave a $29 billion gift to J.P. Morgan Chase to buy up the rest of Bear Stearns' assets. The Fed was under pressure to support Lehman Brothers when it was collapsing. So the Dodd-Frank Act says that the Fed should not be engaged in bailing out any of these too big to fail institutions, but that the Fed can continue to have liquidity and support programs as long as those programs have broad-based eligibility. It does require a certain vote of the Board of Governors, of the governors on the Federal Reserve Board, and the approval of the Treasury Secretary, but those procedural requirements should not be insurmountable. So it gets to the idea of, well, what is a broad-based program of eligibility? If the Fed were to, for instance, buy shares in State Infrastructure Day, that would seem to be a program of broad-based eligibility. Any infrastructure bank in the country would be eligible. And if the Fed were to buy shares or make loans to those infrastructure banks would suddenly have a lot more resources to start addressing what is a real critical problem in this country. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers, this country is facing a multi-trillion dollar deficit in infrastructure. And, it doesn't happen every day, but it does happen now and then where a bridge will just collapse with drivers on the bridge now and then. It's almost like waiting for the next catastrophe and kicking the can down the road for the next generation to have to deal with this infrastructure deficit. So the Fed could help solve the infrastructure needs by having this kind of a program for funding state infrastructure banks. And, of course, it wouldn't just build or rebuild the aging infrastructure of this country from not just bridges but sewage treatment facilities, whatever you can imagine. There's an awful lot of declining infrastructure. It would also help employment and the construction industry a great deal. The construction industry took an enormous hit from the decline in housing, and it hasn't really come back. It probably won't come back anytime soon the way it had been prior to the housing collapse. But, redirecting the construction industry and workforce to infrastructure rebuilding would be a very wise strategy at this point.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I didn't understand that before, what broad-based eligibility meant. So what you mean is that they can't lend to one bank to save that bank, but they could make this available to all banks, let's say, or, all of
that's
them
right.
In a category, and then it would pass.
That's right, and that's essentially what the QE program is. That's a system. That's a program of broad-based eligibility. The Fed will buy the mortgage-backed securities from anyone on their list who's eligible to be selling them these mortgage-backed securities.
Cool. So what do you think about Janet Yellen? Is she more bold than Bernanke?
I think she's very much the same. I was just watching her today on cable TV, her testimony to the House Financial Services Committee. She was saying today that there have been significant job gains in the economy, but that there's still a significant unemployment problem and a significant problem dealing with income inequality. But her solution for this is really more of the same of the Bernanke approach, which is for the Fed to continue buying bonds. She is now committed to tapering the bond buying to try to reduce it from the present level of $65 billion. The forecasts are that it might be reduced at the late March meeting to $55 billion a month. She conceded that they'll have to look at the next jobs report and see if there's a real problem. She implied that maybe they wouldn't taper to $55 billion and they keep it at $65 billion. That was the implication, at least. But it's the same fundamental strategy that if things are real bad, what can the Fed do? It can engage in this trickle-down approach where it buys bonds from big banks and bond dealers, and with the hopes that the increased reserves in the banking system will then be lent out to Main Street, even though the evidence seems quite contrary, that the banking system is sitting on a couple of trillion dollars of excess reserves that have not been lent out. The same with income inequality. You know, she agonizes that there might be some structural problems. She doesn't identify what they are. She says that there's a real income gap between skilled and unskilled, so we need to focus on education, but there's nothing really the Fed can do about that. So I don't think there's much difference between her and Bernanke on that side. Would there be much difference between her and Bernanke on regulation of financial institutions is, I think, a question that's still to be answered.
And she said that there's not much you can do about education, but Elizabeth Warren had suggested that if the banks can borrow at 0.75%, why couldn't students? So what do you think of that? I have a response.
Oh, I think it's a great idea of Warren's, of Senator Warren. I've said before that the Fed could actually, theoretically, could just purchase up $1 trillion of outstanding student debt and declare a moratorium on the repayment. You know, that would certainly help young people who are saddled with student debt and who are having a very tough time finding a job and an income in this economy. So there's a lot the Fed could do directly that would help the student debt problem, but you're not going to get that kind of a solution from Janet Yellen.
Yeah. I heard somebody objecting that the difference is that they'll lend to banks because banks are good credit risk, but they won't lend to students because they're not. Well, the reason the banks are good credit risk is that the government underwrites them. If the government didn't bail out the banks, they would have been bankrupt long ago, the big Wall Street banks.
Absolutely.
So what if the government guaranteed a job for the students when they came out of school, as has been done historically or has been done in other countries, and it works? You know, then I know in Australia and New Zealand, they don't have to pay back their student loan. I think they're interest-free. They don't have to pay back their student loans until they get a job, and if they never get a job, they don't have to pay it back. And then when the money comes back, then they lend it out to someone else, and that has worked quite well, and it hasn't bankrupted the system, as you might think.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with you. You take a look at the GI Bill of Rights after World War II. The GI Bill basically helped 16 million returning veterans from that war, and it provided them with very low interest loans on mortgages, all kinds of jobs, training programs, and jobs programs, and incidentally, tuition-free higher education, four-year college degree at any university in the world with a living stipend. And while that might sound extravagant in the way that we look at the economy today, it was not just successful in helping millions of people and their families. It was a very efficient, fiscally sound program. Over the lifetimes of that generation, the GI generation, the greatest generation, the GI Bill of Rights paid for itself more than seven times over just in the tax revenues that were generated by helping people become productive workers over their lifetimes. It's an investment that pays for itself.
I wanted to ask about something else you've written, a different paper on the public banking solution at a more local level, such as, I mean, we only have one example, the Bank of North Dakota. So I wondered if you could comment on that as an alternative model.
Well, my comments are very supportive of the Bank of North Dakota as a model. I have to defer to experts like you and others. I think the work you and others have done has been inspiring to watch. My own research is focused more on, you know, the federal level, national institutions, but the more I read about the Bank of North Dakota, and a lot of that reading, a lot of my learning has come from you, the more convinced I am that this would be a great solution to the problems we're facing today. I did notice that just in the past week, the Inspector General of the United States Postal Service came out with a report that reminded everybody that the postal system used to be that kind of a public bank, that it had 4 million depositors right up until the mid-1960s, and that, according to the Inspector General, it still has the statutory power to engage in this kind of retail banking. And the report also pointed out that something like a quarter of the population, mostly very low-income population in this country, do not have access to just regular retail banking facilities at anything resembling affordable costs. And Senator Elizabeth Warren seems to have endorsed this Inspector General's report as well. So I wondered, do you think this would be a way to move forward on public banking in this country? I know right now it's happening at a state-by-state level, and it's inspiring to see the efforts that are taking place across the country in states where there are efforts to try to incorporate and charter public banks at the state or local level.
I think it's a great idea, and it's a particularly great idea for servicing the unbanked part of the population. What I like about the state bank model, like the Bank of North Dakota, is it's something to do with your public revenues, your state and local tax money, et cetera, that's, first of all, safe. It avoids the bail-in problem. But you can, and then you can leverage your capital and deposits. Like California, for example, has a huge capital base and a huge deposit base. Imagine if you put all that to work creating credit the way a bank does. So you're not spending the money; you're actually duplicating it in the form of bank credit. So basically, doubling your money is credit. I know you wrote about California, and that's my state and my issue.
It used to be my home state for a while, and I was very frustrated while I lived there. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a couple of public banking bills, and perhaps not unrelated to that, the governor's job czar was a former Bank of America official. So, you know, the opposition to this is not really a fair fight. A lot of times the opposition is really just based on trying to, you know, monopolize banking through the private banking institutions that aren't doing a very good job meeting our needs to begin with.
Yeah, so I know you're growing short on time, but I wondered if you wanted to wrap up with any statements or any websites you want to promote or anything you want us to know about you.
Well, my publications are easy for your listeners to find just by Googling my name. I think you mentioned the most recent ones as this book chapter published by Oxford University Press, a book called When Government Helps. I'm working on a couple of other books right now, so, you know, down the road I hope you'll have me back on for, you know, future interviews when I can talk about my latest publications. But I want to just thank you for having me on and for doing what you're doing. I'm a big believer in your work and the work of the Public Banking Institute. It's a perspective that I think is catching on across the country, and the more people come to learn about our system of money and banking, the more outraged they are. And this is not an issue that appeals to just people on one side of the political spectrum. It really is across the spectrum. And I think the cartels, the financial oligarchy, the powers that be, and their bought and paid for representatives in Congress and across the country want to keep people mostly ignorant about this system of money and banking. And it's not as complex as one would think. And I think all we need to do is to look back in American history and see that there are other periods when we had different approaches to money and banking, and it met with a lot more success and resulted in a much fairer distribution of the economic pie for everybody.
Thanks, Tim. And I'd love to have you on again because you're such a wealth of knowledge.
Thank you, Alan. Anytime. And thank you for all your work.
Okay. Bye.
Come to a time in the show now that we're going to call the Public Banking Reports, in which on almost every show we'll be doing an update and an investigation or looking into what's going on around the country in building a public banking movement and also in the adoption of municipal public banks in states and cities and counties around the U.S. Fortunate to have today with us not just Ellen, who was one of the founders of the Public Banking Institute, but her colleague Mike Krause, my colleague Mike Krause as well, who is one of the founding a member of the board of directors. Mike, welcome to the It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.
This is exciting.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ellen. The Public Banking Institute, which is the prime mover behind the public banking initiative around the country, it got its start at the end of 2010. And Ellen, maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about how that went down and where it's come through so far.
In 2008, when we had the collapse, after the Lehman Brothers collapse, I was watching the states go down, and at first there were four states that were still solvent, then there were three, then there were two, then there was one, and the one survivor was North Dakota, which also I knew was the only bank that had its, or the only state that had its own state-owned bank. So I thought that was great, and I started writing about it. I was quite sure there was a connection there, so I wrote about all the things that they were able to do in North Dakota with their state-owned bank. And I got a lot of email, more email than I could handle, so someone suggested that I started Google Groups so they could all talk to each other and I wouldn't have to answer all this email. And then after a couple of years, we had some really great people in our Google group who knew a lot. And so we really delved into these issues and figured out what was really going on. And after 2 years, we felt like we should be doing something more, that it was time to get out there and really try to get some state banks set up or try to agitate to get our politicians to understand this concept to bring some legislation. So at the end of 2010, we had it was just a workshop at Sergio Lube's in California, and we formed an institute. So anyway, within 3 months, state legislation started appearing. We didn't actually do it. It was just a concept that had caught on then. And so at first there were three bills, and then there were four. Pretty soon, after a couple of years, 20 states had brought bills of one sort or another for state-owned banks. And so that was our perceived mission, and what we've done ever since is to try to get state banks set up. And Mike, do you want to say what you've done in Pennsylvania, which is really quite good?
Well, let's go back to 2008. After a career earlier in my life in public service and government politics, I spent 30 years in international transportation distribution, moving freight around the world. And I came back to North America in late 2008, just in time to see things fall apart. And I knew nothing really, despite my career in business, I didn't really understand how American banking worked. But I knew the banks were important, so I went looking and researching, and I wrote a column, a three-part column about the Federal Reserve, and my eyes were opened. I discovered in my research who really runs the show. Not the Congress, it's the Fed. And the Fed's a cartel, a private cartel, and it represents its major shareholders, which are the biggest banks. And I said, oh, now this all kind of makes sense. We're bailing out the banks via the Fed because the banks basically own the Fed. And in my research, I found my way to Ellen's writing. And I've been involved with a lot of implementation of things. That's, I guess, my specific skill. I'd never really been involved in the policy formation part. And this is exciting. This group was really driving policy formation. It wasn't clear then that was going to happen. But it looked to me like Ellen and those folks understood what was going on. I thought, well, I want to be a part of that. And somehow I got connected with Ellen, and the rest is history, as they say. We've done a lot as a group to push public banking into the national conversation. We are facilitating bills in different state legislatures, but even more exciting from my point of view is we have broadened this effort to include county and city governments, which also have the capacity to set up public banks. And that's an exciting prospect, a network of public banks around the country, a viable alternative to the Fed for creating affordable credit, locally directed, locally applied, to rescue our local economies. I'm what used to be a Republican, and this idea of lots of local input and control appeals to me. I think that's very Republican, small r, very American. I think this country's greatest strength is still its diversity, and I think public banking enables that diversity.
So the organization, the Public Banking Institute, for those who don't know, it's nonprofit, nonpartisan, transpartisan, as some people say, is a group of citizen activists and academics and policymakers who are working in places around the country. What are some of the most vibrant areas now that are underway in your view, Ellen, in terms of locations?
Probably the most vibrant are Northern California, Pennsylvania, and Vermont. Would you agree with that, Mike?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Vermont's very exciting. Those folks have, I think, somewhere between 17 and 23 town meetings putting public banking on their agenda to support it. And that's how they, you know, Vermont, that's how they govern themselves. They have old-fashioned style New England town meetings. That's where it gets done. And that is very exciting. In Pennsylvania, we have not yet really approached the state legislature. It's a daunting task for all kinds of reasons. We made a decision early on that we had better prospects the more locally we were focused. I explain it this way. If your congressman or your state senator and his wife go off for a three-day all-expense-paid, you know, Principles of Modern Banking conference sponsored by Wells Fargo Bank in Cabo or someplace like that, you don't hear about it. But if your county councilman or your county commissioner shows up with a tan and folks say, "Where you been?" "Oh, I was this banking conference in Cabo." "Really? Tell me about that." Word gets around. So we're really better off. We have more leverage the more locally we are focused, because you can walk in and see your county commissioner, and you can walk in and see your councilman on city council. They're easier to get to. So, and there are fewer of them to make a decision. Now, it takes a couple hundred legislators to make something happen in Pennsylvania, in both houses, plus the governor, a long, drawn-out process. But, you know, you can get two or three county commissioners in almost any Pennsylvania county to say, "Yeah, let's do it," and you can do it. Now, you know, mind you, they have parties to deal with. They have local interests to deal with. Not quite as easy as that, but it's easier. And it plays to our model of building the foundation. We think if we can get enough local efforts going, then the state government is kind of compelled to pay attention after a while. So we're aiming for as many local banks we can get. And that's a function of capital. You want to come with enough money to make a difference. You know, an $8 million bank isn't really going to cut it. But we have counties in Pennsylvania with more people than all North Dakota. Several, as a matter of fact. Well able to capitalize a bank. We have cities like Philadelphia, the fifth largest in America. Pittsburgh, not tiny. Well able to capitalize a public bank. And well able to assemble the team, the people, the talent, the bankers, and committed citizens who can make this work. So we've taken that approach, and we're working in Philadelphia, little city of Reading, Pennsylvania, God love them, now Pittsburgh, a county, Luzerne County, up around Wilkes-Barre, and we're looking at one of the major suburban counties as our next beachhead in Pennsylvania, just getting it out there at different kinds of communities with different needs, but all of which can be assisted by a public bank, we think.
And all of these initiatives are basically grassroots, right? There's no big moneyed organizational thrust. This is, I believe, pretty much ad hoc intention of locals.
As Ellen and I both well know, there's no big money paying our salaries because we don't get a salary. Any donor out there wants to change that, we're available. But we're not. You know, this is very much a volunteer effort, and that's useful. But this is very much coming from the people. We're trying to encourage that, of course. You know, it's not exactly accidental. We are out there actively spreading this word and this news. But people are responding, and that's the cool thing. And people are responding. I had the great joy occasionally of talking to audiences, and I watched them come alive. I watched them figure it out, just the way I did, by the way. It was complicated. I didn't really understand how our banking actually worked. But, you know, then the light bulbs went on, so I'm like, oh, that's how it works. Now I know why they're doing what they're doing. And sometimes in front of an audience, you know, you see the faces light up and people figure it out. And they get very excited when they realize just how they're being ripped off.
So what happens then when a town or a city or a county actually gets around to adopting a public bank? What changes?
Everything. before we get to that, let me just address some of the challenges. We're going to have a public bank. That's easy to say, harder to do. At the end of the day, public officials must take some public funds, whether through a bond issue, which is debt, no one likes that, or from their investments and their rainy day funds, which is actually quite feasible, and they capitalize the public bank. To get them to do that, they have to see the benefits, and that has to be really spelled out for that locality. This is not kind of a vague thing where it's a kind of a good idea, why don't you pop $20 million into this? They're going to have to see a serious presentation of the benefits. We have to work with them to help them identify a source of capital, which are not readily apparent to everybody, but they're there. We have to assist them in talking about mission, but that's really a local effort, and local folks will decide that. And we have to suggest some idea of governance. By that I mean, how do you make this bank accountable to the people, which means through their elected representatives, but how to keep the politicians out of the bag. And I want to be real clear about this. I don't know about California, but if I told the good people of Pennsylvania we were going to give the General Assembly a bank, they'd say, are you crazy? I mean, you just wouldn't do it. So that people understand that you don't want politicians running a bank. You want bankers running a bank.
So what are some of the specific advantages that a town, city, or municipality would reap by having a public bank, Ellen?
To me, the main advantage is that you save all the costs of banking. And it turns out right now, interest takes 35% to 40% of the cost of all public projects on average. For example, in California, in San Francisco, they rebuilt the Bay Bridge, and it was supposed to be $5 billion. It turned out to be $10 billion, and the other five was interest. So that's all money that goes to Wall Street. If we have our own bank, we save that. And a local county or a city bank could do the same thing. In San Francisco, I just read an article on credit card fees, which are way higher than most people realize, that the credit card company makes about 33% a year or more on credit cards because they get 2% per transaction from the merchant. So we, the consumers, don't really notice it. We think we're getting free credit. But the bank is getting this 2% every time you buy something from the merchant, and those loans are on average only 25 days. So if you compound that over the course of a year, 2% for 25 days comes out to 33.5% over a year. So all those charges, San Francisco, just the city and county of San Francisco, pays $4 million annually for bank fees. So that's all money they could save if they owned the bank themselves. So it's, in other words, it's a big moneymaker for the state or local government. But also you can use it to direct credit where you need it in the economy, to partner with local banks, to allow the local banks to make much larger loans than they would otherwise make. In North Dakota, they give 1% loans to startup farms and businesses. They make low interest loans to students. So there are many things you can do with your own bank that Wall Street would not do for you.
Well, I think we need to recognize that since the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act with the Leach, Graham, whatever bill, and the banks were allowed to combine their investment in banking activities, they basically abandoned banking in favor of speculation. So that the real economy is essentially starved for affordable credit. Now, community banks, to some extent, have stepped into that void, and God love them. But they're under stress. You know, the new Dodd-Frank regulations, let's say it costs J.P. Morgan $18 million a year to comply. They don't care. But if it costs your local bank and trust company another $300,000 to comply, they do care. That's a huge chunk out of their bottom line, their profits, puts huge stress on those banks. So they're scrambling to meet the needs of their community, and they need help. And a public bank can really help the local banking, credit union, finance industry by supporting them, giving them more reach into the marketplace, competing against the big out-of-state banks, being more profitable, and taking back market share. And again, it's almost obvious to say that a banker who's 20 miles away from you, who goes to a church in your community, whose kids go to school in your community, whose wife's on the garden club, the banker's on the vestry, his wife's on the vestry of the church, or the synagogue governing, they're part of their community. They have a feel for their community. It's better if those folks make lending decisions than some person, guy or gal, sitting at a desk 600 miles away who doesn't know beans about your community. That's the benefit, one of the benefits, of local banking, which public banking does support.
Right, so the community bankers become really our allies, or should be allies, as this movement goes forward in the next couple of years.
As should local elected officials. Alan's point about interest is just maybe the tip of the iceberg. So much money goes out of our communities, never be seen again in interest payments, in credit swaps, in all those fancy products Wall Street sold, and in fees and in commissions. Goes out of the community, never to be seen again. We want to keep all our money circulating locally, and we want our assets put to work locally.
There's another factor, and that's the fraud factor. Now, JPMorgan Chase has been caught in over a dozen serious frauds, and yet we're still doing business with them. Why are we doing business with proven crooks? It's because we think we have no alternative. But we actually do have an alternative if we set up our own banks.
So this is a fight that's going to be expanding and is expanding, and we've got a lot of work to do. What is the strategy? Do you feel like the states are the target? What's the most potent area for adoption of?
Well, yeah, they all have potential. In California, we had a bill that passed both houses of the legislature in 2.5 years ago, and Governor Brown failed to sign it. And his argument was that it was a bill for a feasibility study, and his argument was that we already have too many committees and that we could do this in-house in the banking committee, but of course we haven't heard any more about it. So I'm actually running for treasurer, for state treasurer on the Green Party ticket on a state bank platform on the theory that if they're not going to do it, we have to get in there and do it ourselves. And Laura Wells is running for controller. And she's also a state bank advocate. She ran for governor earlier on that platform.
So I know the Public Banking Institute is all over the country with various agents and people and committees and so forth doing a variety of things. We'll be following as many of those things as possible in this segment of the It's Our Money with Ellen Brown show. We're going to wrap it up now and look for further conversations with you and Mike and many others as the It's Our Money show returns. Thanks very much, Ellen and Mike.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this first edition of the It's Our Money show with Ellen Brown. As an update on the town meeting day election results in Vermont, by a 3-to-1 margin in a direct democracy non-binding vote, residents approved a measure calling on the state legislature to create a public bank within the state's development authority. A Gunn Foundation study said that doing so would create almost 3,000 jobs and add hundreds of millions of dollars to state productivity, even with only 10% of Treasury funds invested. This landslide result will no doubt encourage other communities around the country that are looking at the public banking option. Next time on It's Our Money, Ellen will be back with a conversation about using eminent domain to recover public equities that have been lost to cities and communities around the country through the ongoing foreclosure crisis. Her guest will be Cornell Professor Bob Hockett, the leading advocate and developer of that legal stratagem that has the banking and finance industries up in arms. I'm Ellen's co-host, Walt McCree. Our thanks to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia and to you for joining us. You can listen to this show via podcast at any time from PRN.FM. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.
Money!